From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, a doctor discovers the truth about heaven. Here's what's happening. Parkland, Florida, that 19-year-old who's accused of gunning down 17 people at his former high school has admitted now to carrying out the shooting rampage. Police wrote that Nicholas Cruz, who has been charged with 17 counts of premeditated murder, told officers that he walked into the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School wielding an AR-15 assault rifle and began shooting students in the hallways and outside on the school's grounds. Once students began to flee the carnage, Cruz dropped his rifle and his vest packed with additional ammunition so he could kind of blend into the crowd. Cruz had taken an Uber to the school, according to officials, so then he fled on foot with those running from the gunfire. An officer found him not long after walking on a residential street. He had already gone to a couple fast food places just to sit and relax. Unbelievable. And the FBI, of course, has launched a review about its handling of a warning about this teenager accused of carrying out Wednesday's school shooting in Florida, which he has now admitted to. Nicholas Cruz reportedly commented on YouTube last year that he would be a professional school shooter. He also posted all kinds of strange things on Facebook and Instagram. Lauren Weinstein is an expert on the internet. Lauren, at what point will they start looking at these signs and taking these things seriously?
Yeah, well, first I want to say my heart goes out to everyone that's been devastated by this tragedy. It's just terrible that we have to keep talking about this kind of issue over and over
again. They keep coming up, don't they?
The problem here that we're dealing with is that 2020 hindsight is perfect, and it can fool us into thinking that it's possible to look at social media ahead of time and predict when something like this is going to occur. In fact, and this is a really, really sad commentary on where we are, that comment that you just noted that he said about how he's going to become a professional school shooter, that is almost benign in comparison to the kinds of things you can find all over the internet, on profiles, in postings, in comments. Everywhere there's pictures of guns and knives and blood. There's people making what appear to be explicit threats. I mean, that isn't even explicit. There's no time or place there, but you see people making all kinds of explicit violent threats. 99%+ of the time, they're never going to do them.
Exactly.
It's just talk. And this puts law enforcement, the FBI, in a bind. In this particular case, they did run that name. And remember, anybody can post anything under any name. That's the first problem we start with. They ran tests through the databases and things and didn't come up with anything relevant. The person who had posted the YouTube video that the shooter had commented on, or the person who the name of the shooter was commented on, was actually in Mississippi, so they didn't have a nexus to go back and look at Florida.
Right. They interviewed him directly, that person who notified them.
Right, because they knew for sure who he was, because
He
had gone to the FBI himself. But when you really come down to it, even if you gave billions of dollars, there's no way to do it, because there's just so much of this out on the internet now, and so much of it looks so much worse. We have a similar problem when it comes to the mental health aspects of this. People are saying, well, you know, if anyone who has a mental health problem, we should be able to pull them in and interview them. But that would probably cover about 4/5 of the population one way or another. I mean, there's an awful lot of people who have some kind of mental problems. The vast majority will never do anything bad. So you kind of have to come down to, in this particular case, you start to wonder about where the difference is. And one question that I have to ask, and I was kind of surprised to hear this myself, was that apparently he was able to buy that AR-15 legally, but he was too young to buy a handgun.
He was also too young for drinking.
And this looks like an aspect of this problem that deserves some serious study, because in this particular case, that just doesn't make any sense to me.
Look, I got to tell you, Lauren, I'm all for the Second Amendment rights. I'm a gun owner myself. I'm a concealed weapons permit holder. But I think we need stringent background checks and age restrictions. I mean, to let an 18-year-old buy an AR-15 is crazy.
It doesn't make any sense at all, and we really have to start thinking about where our priorities are in these kinds
of
situations.
You got it. Lauren, thank you so much. I always appreciate your feedback. Well, even the wrappers for fast food are bad for you. Listen to this. Fast food wrappers contain chemicals, and exposure to them appears to slow down the metabolism, according to new research out of Harvard School of Public Health. Slow metabolism can lead to weight gain and can also get in the way of weight loss. A single protein building block commonly found in food may hold a key to preventing the spread of an often deadly type of breast cancer, according to a new study published today in the medical journal Nature. Investigators found that by limiting an amino acid called asparagine in laboratory mice with triple-negative breast cancer, they could dramatically reduce the ability of the cancer to travel to distant sites in the body. Among other techniques, the team used dietary restrictions to limit the use of asparagine. Foods rich in this include dairy, beef, poultry, eggs, fish, seafood, asparagus, potatoes, nuts, seeds, soy, and whole grains. Foods low include most fruits and vegetables. So there's your diet. Scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have discovered what they claim is an atmospheric aerosol particle enriched with uranium, which is used in nuke fuel and bombs. They have no idea how it got in there, and it's spreading somewhere over Alaska's Aleutian Islands. That's weird. U.S. stocks bouncing back higher after briefly slipping into negative territory, pushing the Dow back about above the 25,000 milestone. Mish Sedlock with us, a registered investment advisor. It keeps popping around like a rubber ball, Mish.
It does, George. But what do you think here? The stocks are overvalued. They gave a sell-off. We're seeing the dip buyers come in, which is what happened. This bounce back is pretty much, I think, according to script here. Where we go from here, George, you know, I don't know. I hate making short-term forecasts, but long-term, this market is still overvalued. George, there is a lot more down to come.
Oh, yeah. That's
I don't
what
know
I
whether it's now or later, but I'm looking at some of these things. Everyone's excited by the Bush tax cuts and stuff, and I'm writing about that on my blog here. George, I don't get it. The average person, they're talking about these average tax cuts these people are going to get, and it's like $1,000 a year. They're averaging it out. I did the median numbers here today, George. You know, the median household is going to get like $300 a year. $30
pays for a little gasoline for the month, right?
Yes, and gasoline tax hikes coming.
Yeah,
George,
the offset,
it doesn't add up.
It doesn't. Mish, thanks. You take care of yourself. In a moment, an old friend joins us as we're talking about true crime. We're going to talk about the future of radio and some other things next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Look, I'm not going to do a long-winded introduction for this guest. He's a longtime friend, and you'll know the name, but we're going to add something to his name. Dr. Ian Punnett, back on Coast to Coast, PhD. Boy, what a great honor. Good for you, and congratulations, Ian.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun working on it. It'll be fun to talk about the research. But, George, if your next guest can actually get us all to talk to heaven, what am I doing going first? That sounds great.
My good. How are you feeling, first and foremost, the tinnitus and everything else?
Well, the tinnitus will just... will never change, although I'm getting better and better at managing it.
Good.
So it's become less of an intrusion in my day.
It's not driving you crazy.
It doesn't. But, you know, it took a long time to get there. So, and then if I'm not mindful about it, it comes back in a way which is very distracting. So thank you for asking.
All right. Now, fill everybody in on what's been happening to you over the last few years. And there are a lot of new people who are probably saying, Ian, who's
Ian?
Really.
Ian who? And I don't blame him. You know, it was fun when I hosted Coast to Coast for all those years and in and around big names like yours and Art. And it was hard to give up Coast, but I'll tell you, going back and getting a PhD was just highly rewarding. And working with young people and being able to create new areas of research, you know, of my own, that part's been really rewarding. So I think the last time we talked was when I had the true crime book that I put out called A Black Knight for the Bluegrass
Bell.
Yeah,
it's about a year and a half ago. Almost.
Something like that, yeah. And it was, and it did well, and it was in People magazine, and I was really happy with it. But it was during that period that I started researching, what is it that makes true crime true crime? When we say true crime, when it's a great true crime story, what does that actually mean? And nobody really had a definition, which is sort of surprising. And there was no. There was no theory of it. Like, you know what journalism is, and we know what best practices are of journalism, but nobody had ever done that for true crime. So that's what I researched for my dissertation, and then that's what came out in a book last week toward a theory of true crime narratives, which nobody listening to Coast should buy for $66. Everybody is forgiven for not rushing out and buying that book.
But it's a textbook, isn't it?
It is a kind of textbook, so that's why the price tag is high. But it's for colleges, universities, it's for high schools even, and for libraries. And if anybody wants to buy it, it's a great read. It'll explain everything you've ever wanted to know about how true crime stories are told and why. Like, why do we have them? Like, what do you think is the first true crime story?
I'm going to guess, now I'm wrong. But I'm gonna guess, because I know it probably goes way back before this. But I would say Truman Capote's In Cold Blood.
Okay, way before that. And if I said to you, and I'm not exaggerating, if I said to you that the first true crime story was probably in the Bible,
I was gonna say that next. You're right.
See. And it actually makes sense, right? Because we get the story of Cain and Abel, and it follows actually the same model for true crime stories. I mean, excepting, you know, for the moment that as many people would believe that the Bible is true. So just putting that aside for the moment, it follows the exact model of that. A crime is committed. A person of interest denies it. God is the first crime investigator, and then the crime is solved, and punishment, you know, is adjudicated after that. So that it's interesting to see that it all kind of comes back to that, I think. And true crime, our interest in conveying messages of morality, messages of even hope and community, come out of telling crime stories, like what's going on in Florida.
Oh, what a sad story.
It is. I mean, just heartbreaking. And we follow that story and we understand the story pretty well, but there are often murders that happen in towns that go unsolved. And it has a way of ripping communities apart. And that's often where true crime steps in. And true crime attempts to tell a long form version, not just a 5 or 6 inches of a story in a, you know, in a newspaper piece, but really digs in and attempts to understand how the story relates to the community, how the blood got into the soil. And true crime does that in ways that journalism can't.
Has social media impacted true crime stories?
Well, that's a great question. In fact, can you think of a time when true crime has ever been this popular? You know, Netflix, HBO's The Jinx.
Amazon, everybody.
Amazon, but even Serial, which was a digital release but connected to NPR. You know, these become huge social media.
Remember Dexter, that Showtime show?
Okay, so Dexter, you know, right, would fall again into crime fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But it speaks to our interest in understanding ourselves. It's a way of the living understanding itself through the dead. And so we're always sort of fascinated with that, because I think we use that to inform what our values are, what our priorities are. And I think that these extremes of these stories are what usually helps us draw better distinctions about what our life is about.
And when you get into some of these true crime stories, Ian, you realize just how sick some of these murderers are, or perpetrators. I mean, it's unbelievable. This tragedy in Florida right now with this young man. I mean, his appointed attorney today said he felt remorse. Remorse?
Yeah.
You know, he just killed 17 people, and injured 14 or 15 people and wounded them. What would possess anybody to do this? And, you know, our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Bregan, who comes on, is convinced that this kid probably was on prescription drugs, on him, off him. He had, you know, his parents had died. Things weren't going well for him. But why do you kill people?
Right. You know, this is, you know, for fame, a sense of noticing that I was here once. It's a way of, in some cases, attempting a very elaborate suicide.
He didn't try that.
No, well,
yet.
He didn't try that, although, and he did, he may have changed his mind. He may have thought that's what he was going to do originally.
Right.
And then didn't. And that, I think what's really compelling about true crime stories, and you brought up In Cold Blood, is that, you know, the best true crime stories, in a way, are not new stories. They're old stories. They're stories, some cases, that are 10, 15, 20 years old, or in the case of the book I wrote, which was, like, you know, 70 years old, and that but the crime, there's something about that crime which resonates with us still. And so that's where, and in a lot of ways, too, like, it's hard to imagine this, that there was a time when Anne Rule, you remember, right?
Mm-hmm,
Anne Rule,
mm-hmm.
The queen of true crime.
Right.
When she wrote The Stranger Beside Me about Ted Bundy, in a lot of ways, nobody, the government.
Ted Bundy, for people who don't know, serial killer.
Right. And a serial killer who started small, in a way, he had a small circle that he was working around Seattle, which is where Anne Rule's beat was.
Uh-huh.
She was writing for true crime magazines, and they were contacting her. As I'm sure you know the story, her editors at the true crime magazines were contacting her saying, look, looks like you've got a hijacker killer in the area. And she's actually talking about it with Ted Bundy, who is the guy who was sitting next to her at the suicide prevention line where they both volunteered once.
Oh, my God.
And Ted was her friend.
Oh.
Ted and
how many had he killed by that time? Do you know?
Two or three.
And then he ended up with, what, six or seven?
Well,
something
like
that?
In a lot of ways, we may never know.
We may never
know. He played footsie with that kind of till the end. But he had, then he went down to Florida, and there were, you know, I think, I'd have to ask Leslie, her daughter, but it's off the top of my head, 11 or 12 before it was done. And I think what was interesting is, you know, is she was telling Ted Bundy, yeah, it looks like I'm going to be writing about this. And he's telling her, oh, what a horrible story. Can you believe somebody's doing that?
30 victims, they say.
30. Right. So here's the, you know, that's the perfect, but what's interesting, the government was not involved. The government wasn't warning girls on college campuses. It wasn't sending out messages, do not hitchhike, there's a, you know, potential killer. So it's really up to true crime writers to fill in that gap. And that's often what true crime does, is it's a way of, for especially women true crime writers, to tell the stories of women who have died as a way of protecting the women who are living. And that's what, you know, true crime does so well, is oftentimes re-examine the older murders, not just the ones that have happened recently.
Here's what Anne Rule says about Ted Bundy. A sadistic sociopath who took pleasure from another human's pain and the control he had over his victims to the point of death and even after.
But remember, it took Anne a while to come to that opinion, and she wrote about that pretty candidly because he was the stranger beside. Even after he was arrested, she was meeting with him, and she's going, Ted, what is this? And he's going, Anne, I'm totally falsely accused here. You got to believe me. And she said, she was very clear, she vacillated on his guilt or innocence until a certain point where she finally said, wait, I know it was you. Yeah. And I mean, it's a compelling read, and yet it also speaks to the idea that true crime are nonfiction stories about a crime that is true, that is told in the manner of one that is not. So they read like fiction, but they are all true.
He was married, I guess, for a while.
For a while. And in fact, a lot of what dictated Ted Bundy's actions was a kind of revenge over the woman that had spurned him. And so he had a type, And it seemed like that type was he was recreating or acting out on the pain that was caused by a woman who looked just like that.
Now, is your book, The Toward a Theory of True Crime Narratives, we're going to hit the break, but I want you to think about this. Is this a book on true crime stories, or is it a book for journalists to investigate true crime stories? We'll be back in a moment with Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast for our special guest for the next hour and a half, Ian Punnett, Dr. Ian Punnett, as we talk about his work toward a theory of true crime narratives. He's also working on a book on car radio and the history of car radio. Amazing. We'll talk about that, too. Three live events coming up back-to-back in three great cities, and the tickets are available now. Salt Lake City, Scottsdale, Arizona, Las Vegas, Nevada. The executive producer of the events, Tom Danheiser. Tom, Salt Lake is going to be fun.
How cool is this going to be? As a matter of fact, I got a call today from the band that we hired. He, the band leader, he did not know that this was the show, like the radio show. He's so excited.
Oh, you finally put two and two together?
Yeah, he's like, oh, I'm going to play for this? Yep, you sure are.
You sure are. Saturday, March 10th in Salt Lake City at the Janae Wagner Theater's three special guests, ancient technology expert Jason Martell, the man who died twice and came back to talk about it, Danian Brinkley, and ufologist Nick Pope will be there. Why is there a band there, Tom?
Well, I hear rumor that somebody's going to sing.
Uh-huh, and then we do a meet and greet afterwards. We'll tell you in a second where you can get tickets for Salt Lake. And with Salt Lake, it's a gorgeous theater, and I want that place sold out. So if you don't have a computer, call their box office at 801-355-2787. And again, in a minute, we'll tell you where you can get the tickets to these events. Because the next event is April 21st in Scottsdale, Arizona.
It sure is, and we're going to do something a little bit different this time. We have a couple guests, and then we're going to do a round table, a UFO round table, and you are going to maestro it.
One of the guests on that table, of course, will be Fire in the Sky's own Travis Walton.
Mr. Travis Walton.
And I just enjoy talking to him wherever we go. And that box office, of course, is the Virginia Piper Theater. That is 480-499-8587. And then now there are going to be many more shows this year, but these are the first three. The next one is June 9th in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Do you need to say any more?
And
Las
we're
going Vegas.
To resurrect Elvis Presley. That's what I hear.
This is going to be amazing and a lot of fun, folks.
And the information there now at the Silverton Casino in Las Vegas. You can call them at 702-263-7777 and then hit #4. When that comes up. Now, in terms of where can you really get all these tickets, go to coasttocoastam.com, click our events at the top of the homepage. It'll open up to whatever city you want to go to. And again, Salt Lake City, Scottsdale, Arizona, or Las Vegas. You can even pick out, in most cases, your own seats. So you'll see the little dots there. You just click that and order your tickets. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our colleague is with us, Dr. Ian Punnett. We're going to take calls with Ian next hour as well. Ian, I'm going to give you a date, and I want you to tell me what you think happened on that date, okay? Right. April 28th, 2001.
April 28th, 2001. I don't know what happened on that date.
It was a Sunday. You took off, and it was my very first Coast to Coast.
That's right, of course.
That was so cool, so cool.
Well, you know, you brought up a great question before the break, and it was exactly what prompted me to do this research. By the way, my wife calls me the Reverend Doctor, and she wants me to get a law degree so I can be Reverend Dr. Ian Punnett Esquire.
I love it.
I'm going to draw the line on that.
Too many titles.
So... But the question was really, it was insightful because this speaks to an ongoing issue. And this is something that's sort of pervasive in the press in general. Now, I study journalism. I study journalism forms. And I love journalism. I love great journalism. But there are rules to journalism. And you were a news director for a long time. And,
yep.
And the rules are there for a reason. It's not just, you know, because it's tradition. You know, it has to be. Where journalism was a kind of social science, where you are presenting facts for people to make up their own minds, not taking a position. And so when the university, when Arizona State University kind of tasked me with this thing about finding where the line is between really good crime journalism and the genre, radio, TV, print, whatever, that we call true crime, where is that line? What happens to a narrative that suddenly it becomes what we call true crime? And I think one of those factors is that true crime takes a position, and journalism should not.
Should not. Of course, we know it does now, but it, in our days, Ian, you know, we stayed right down the middle.
It was stricter. And, and of course, many people still do it down the middle, but they also play to a more fractured market, right? So we are back in a time like we were in the 1800s, where there was 150 newspapers on every street corner. And, you know, there was the Daily Swedish American, and then there was the Danish American, and one was in Danish, the other was in Swedish. I mean, they just, everybody had a newspaper. And it's a little bit more like that, where people can pick and choose their news sources online, on cable, or whatever. And so that has changed the dynamic quite a bit, where people are now being a little bit more abrasive, and they're representing a particular point of view that's consistent with the demographic that they're trying to appeal to. But true crime, you know, and why these stories resonate with us is because they're often pursuing justice. So, like Making a Murderer on Netflix, or The Keepers on Netflix, which were two really good true crime series. They were trying to shake the tree. One was trying to get somebody convicted that had never been charged for a crime, in this case a priest involved in the death of a nun, and the other was trying to get a new trial or get a new look of justice on somebody who, to the perspective of the people who put together Making a Murderer, had gotten railroaded. And that's, so there's the difference right there in a way. True crime has an attitude. It's often subversive, it often challenges the status quo, and it calls out law enforcement sometimes and says, you all have to be doing this better, and frequently gives a reason or an explanation for how, you know, Department of Justice or how various law enforcement bodies can do better.
What do you want someone who picks up this book, and some people are going to buy it, Ian, you know that.
I hope so.
But what do you want them to take away from this book?
Well, if somebody really wanted to write true crime, this is a great start, because there aren't roadmaps for that. And but if you're, you know, if by the way, and I was being flip before when I said, you know, people shouldn't buy it, but I you know, certainly if you're a university or a college or
buy it, or a library,
please buy it or a library. Yeah, it's very helpful. But I think what's really helpful is to try to understand how narrative works, right? How do stories work? And there's something that's very coast to coast about this concept, because anybody who's hosting and you're talking to somebody for 2 or 3 hours, we have the luxury of rolling out a story with a beginning and a middle and an end. It doesn't have to be the bullet points. It doesn't have to be an encapsulation. People can tell the story of how something happened. And that's important, because that's how we understand ourselves through stories much better than we understand ourselves through static facts.
Everybody, of course, is talking about this horrific situation in Florida in the schools, and now the people, of course, who are for guns, against guns, everybody's jumping on that bandwagon right now. The unfortunate part about this is, I believe in a free society, these things are going to happen again and again and again.
You know, and you hit on a point which I was talking with, I've talked about this before, that some of this has to do with the fame piece. You know, we have become such a fame-centric culture. And not only that, but it's instant fame. And for some people, it's always been true that there's been people who have sought infamy because it's cheap and easy, right? Do something really horrible and you're famous. And I think that, unfortunately, this idea of school shootings, and we saw, and let's not forget, remember there was a woman today in Oregon, I believe, who turned in her own grandson.
Mm-hmm.
Who she suspected was going to be doing something at his school.
And good for her.
Exactly. But again, the kid, according to what I read, was obsessed with the idea of becoming famous and wanting people to pay attention to them. And I think that this is something about our culture, which a bell we can't unring. We do have to figure out that as much as we figure out the gun thing. And I just hope that people are aware of that, that it isn't just a matter of mental illness. It's an obsession we have with getting rich quick, you know, and getting, you know, being the, you know, breaking the internet, you know, and all of these types of concepts, which I think it's a little hard, perhaps even for older people to even imagine. But those are new center points for people who are coming of age.
I was on the air October 1st. It was Sunday night. I do the first Sunday now, Ian, of every month.
Right.
And that's when the Las Vegas shooter occurred.
Right.
And Tom, I'm in St. Louis, so he's talking in my ear, and he says, George, there's something going on in Las Vegas. And he said, I think one or two people have been shot. And I said, well, check into it. Let me know. And I'm on the air. And all of a sudden, we're getting information that a couple people had died, and then it exploded.
Right.
And then they're saying, you know, lots of fatalities, and it was unbelievable. They still can't figure out this guy's motive.
Right.
They don't know.
Right. And you know what? Here's another part that I'm so glad you brought up. What? You know, this is. I'm going to say something that's. I mean, I know this is going to make a lot of people mad, but I'm going to say it anyway. What's wrong with not knowing? Why do we think we get to know everything?
Well, I'm not mad, but I want the answers. I want closure. That's what I want. I want closure.
I totally do, too. But I think that's this instant thing, and I'm not saying you're putting it on an instant framework, but, you know, there may be some things we just don't ever know, and there are some things that'll just be never knowable, and it may be because somebody decided in reference to what we were just talking about, that they didn't want anybody to know, so they didn't tell anybody, and they didn't write it down, and they'd rather have everybody walking around wondering about them for the rest of their lives than satisfy that question. And so we sometimes think, well, somebody's got to know. It has to be written down somewhere. Maybe not. And I think that's, you know, that is another thing about when a tragedy strikes. Is so often people put it immediately into a story context, and they're immediately trying to think, okay, well, what story does this fit? Which narrative model does this story, you know, fall into? And so they look for those familiar codes in these stories. Oh, I see, it's this kind of story, or it's that kind of story. It may not be, and reality may not be creating its own whole new narrative that none of us have ever seen before.
True crime. Now, you're also working on a book on car radio. Tell me about that.
Well, so this is fascinating. So I got brought in. This is not my book, but I brought it. I was co-author on the project, and I am grateful to be involved in it. So the full-time author on this is a woman from San Jose State, and her name is Phyllis Johnson, and she's been researching it, and several other people have been contributing to it, and I was kind of brought in to make sure the book gets finished and to finish a couple of these chapters. So it's become one of my little research projects, is to understand car radio, and then our next book that Phyllis and I are working on is going to be the future of radio. And so we're trying to figure out both the, you know, how did we get to where we are, and what's the trajectory for radio in the future? What's George Norrie or Coast to Coast going to be like in 5 years?
You've got to interview me because I've got some ideas.
Well, tell me, this is kind of compelling because a lot of people didn't see car radio coming. And the very first time that there was a car radio, this is kind of funny, 1904 was the first known demonstration of car radio. It was at you'll love this, 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis.
St. Louis, that's right.
And a wireless radio in an automobile was demonstrated, but there were no radio stations yet. So there was nothing that you could tune into, but somebody was already thinking in 1904, wouldn't it be cool if you could put a radio inside of a car? There were no stations, but they were thinking someday there might be. And so that becomes sort of this very interesting thing about how we work as people, because even after that, you know, car batteries, they couldn't handle. I mean, the idea of giant vacuum tube radios inside of a car, it was insane.
It
so
was
what people
nuts.
Used to do, though, is long before they started to make car radios, people would lug those 40 or 50 pound, you know, mahogany boxes out into the front seat of their car, strap it in, hook it up to the battery of their car, and drive around with the living room radio in the front seat of their car.
Well, Ian, look what has happened to television. I mean, my gosh, when I was in my television news director days, you know, television station values were huge. Local stations cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and depending on the market you were in. And, you know, nowadays, you can watch a television program on your smartphone.
Well,
I mean, you don't even need this huge television station to broadcast it to you anymore.
Not at all. In fact, that the interesting piece is you go down to a demographic, a younger demographic, under 40, I think now, and the overwhelming percentage of videos viewed by that group, and I could look up the number here in a second, the videos viewed are viewed on a 3x5 screen.
Yes, exactly.
So, I mean, and what's even more interesting about that is how much of that video is now being made by those same handheld devices, because people are going to look at it on those handheld devices. So that's having an impact right there in the way in which journalism is being taught, and how things are going to be shot and how information is going to be disseminated. If everything's at the end of your arm, right? I mean, if you're going to, you can make it, edit it, send it out, and receive it all on a 3x5 or whatever screen. That's going to, you know, that changes everything. You don't have to bump it back to a station.
Well,
you don't have a news director. You don't have to.
It's amazing. I mean, I could take a video of this studio right now with our buddy Dan Galante over there on the board,
Dan,
and stuff like that. He's waving to you right now. And send it to you through the airwaves.
Right.
And you'll get it in seconds. I mean, that's technology to me that is truly remarkable.
Well, and this is where, you know, so here's. Here's another thought, though. Whatever was old is also new again. So one of the trends that's coming up is all of this short-form programming. And people are talking about, you know, 15-minute podcasts, which, you know, podcasts have been around for a long time, and that's nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of scripted podcasts and serial podcasts, this is a very hot idea. People writing scripted podcasts and doing serial podcast.
Like old-time radio shows.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't, you know, but for some, that's a whole new concept. And like, oh, I listened to it, and then I had to listen to the next show. And I'm like, can you imagine having to wait a whole week before the next show?
Well, you know, what's amazing, the old-time radio hosts of the old days in the entertainment shows, the Jack Benny programs and stuff, all those people then made the migration into television when TV came out. You know, everybody who was on radio at the time, Bing Crosby, all of those guys.
Well, and yet a lot of them also made it via the film. So, you know, that was kind of the interesting piece, too. A lot of these radio stars were created entirely on radio. There was a whole set of movie stars, and then there were radio stars, and then Hollywood started bringing the radio stars and putting them on the big screen. Because when TV first came on, they were calling them radio movies.
That's right.
Right.
And they needed big names, and those radio folks had big names then.
And you think about the Lone Ranger, which I was just talking about with the students the other day. I was visiting in Fresno State, and we were talking about, it seems inconceivable that of what is going on, but one of the things about podcasting and this trend in scripted podcasting is that shows are being essentially storyboarded that they're hoping are going to catch as TV shows or movies, and they're storyboarding them by doing a podcast of them. So they're doing, you know, and that's a lot like what happened with something like The Lone Ranger or
mm-hmm.
The Green Hornet, which were all radio serials that started in Detroit, right?
That's
and then
right.
They went from there, they went national, and then we associate them on all of these different platforms. But they started with just a bunch of people and a microphone putting on a show like podcasts are doing right now in this hot new trend about scripted podcasts.
Most of them on WXYZ radio
probably,
at the time.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. You know it better than I do.
I worked for them when I was 19 years old for the radio and television station at the time.
It's amazing that so many of these franchises and Dragnet, you know, as a radio franchise, and how many of them were doing the commercials inside of the show.
Yep. Right? And live.
Right. And live, which is just like what's happening now.
That's right.
Where they're doing these incorporations where people are like, well, can you put the product in the show? And it's like, again, that's a new trend in a lot of ways for certain platforms, but it's a very old idea for radio.
Ian, we're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls with you as we continue talking about your work. And his latest book is called Toward a Theory of True Crime Narratives. You can get it. We'll find out where you can get it, but Amazon for sure.